Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about director Barry Levinson, or as I always like to think about him, Baltimore director Barry Levinson, because this is a native son. This is somebody local, very well known and beloved, if only because he's local and he's done so much great stuff to make Baltimore look good. But Mike, since you're also a Baltimore guy, set us up for the early, you know, origin story for Barry Levinson.
Working as a film critic, I first interviewed Barry Levinson in 1979. He was the screenwriter for And Justice for All, a Norman Jewison directed film starring Al Pacino, all about the court system in Baltimore, very much filmed in Baltimore. We'll talk about that presently. And I've interviewed him since then a few times for Tin Man and some other things, and probably met him around, gosh, six or seven times beyond that at just various events in Baltimore. He's come back. He's a Baltimore guy who has not forgotten his hometown. So anyway, on a lot of his return visits, I had a chance, you know, just to talk in a theater lobby or hang out a little bit. So, you know, I know his work, certainly, and know him to some extent from the interviews and just social encounters to chat about things. But by way of his biographical background, yes, very much a Baltimore guy. Jewish family in Baltimore, very much row house culture, and moving to the suburbs, in his case, meant moving from, you know, like central Baltimore to Forest Park to like West Baltimore, where you could finally have some lawn, you know, some green grass and a tree and, you know, things like that. But very much a local guy. And he, in his Baltimore films, he's made four films that are specifically set in Baltimore. He's oftentimes directly referenced aspects of his own biography. He oftentimes will say, there's no one character in this film or that film that's me, but there are aspects of my personality in this guy and that guy and so on. So he plays off of that. And there's so much shot locally that, I mean, as a Baltimore guy, you know, I look for the street signs. I know the locations. I can point out where that house is, if you will. So it's an ancillary pleasure for anyone who's, you know, growing up in the same town. The films can be enjoyed by anyone, but what an extra level of pleasure. Now, in terms of how he works things into his films, and I'll weave this through his early biography, his father ran a discount appliance warehouse. That's one of the important plot strands in Avalon. You know, he works that indirectly. For that matter, his mother's maiden name was Kraczynski. That's the name of the family in Avalon, his most overtly autobiographical film. We could go on and on that way. In terms of how he went on, very much a modest Baltimore guy by way of upbringing. Talking with him, he's really casual in conversation. He's not at all full of himself or anything. You know, he's got a straightforward Baltimore personality. Let's put it that way. I found him really easy to talk to. When I talked to him for Injustice for All, he wasn't that well known either, right? So, you know, he was becoming well known because of articles I was writing and other people were writing, like, hey, local kid makes good. I mean, that was sort of what was getting him launched that way. But anyway, as a young man, he sold encyclopedias. He also sold used cars. I mean, talk about a modest way of getting into business. He was attending, you know, junior college, as they called it back then, what we would call like Howard Community College. In this case, it was Baltimore City Community College. He transfers, and this is significant. I'm reluctant to always give credit to Washington, but this is a Baltimore guy who first really becomes known in D.C. He transfers to American University. He majors in broadcast journalism. His real interest is TV at that point, more so. He'll be very critical of television in many of his later films, including Avalon and Tin Man. He also gets a part-time job at the TV station WTOP. He's doing a little bit of everything here. It's sort of like, yeah, you know, I'll help edit tape, I'll sweep the floors, whatever, that, you know, a college age thing. He finally just decides to pick up and go, and he drives to Los Angeles. This is the kind of thing you do when you're in your early 20s, right? He drives to LA, he signs up for acting lessons. He wants to become a stand-up comedian. And Marie and I will talk about this, that he's actually got a kind of, not exactly a side career, but a side aspect of the career, at least in cameos, making appearances in a lot of movies over the years. And so anyway, he does early stand-up and comedy writing and so on. It's really TV that starts to become the breakthrough. He writes for Carol Burnett and Marty Feldman and any number of people. He's part of the writing stable. So the general public's not going to know his name really at this point, but they know his work, right? And that helps later on. How it ties into the biography. Here's one quick example. He works on some of the scripts for Happy Days, for that TV series. And he's often said that he drew on his own upbringing in Forest Park, which is a, you know, a leafy quasi-suburb on the west side of Baltimore. He thought about growing up there as a, you know, a nice Jewish kid and a stable, loving family, all that. That was loving in the sense of arguing all the time, you know, affectionate arguments. But anyway, he brought a lot of that to Happy Days. He had a kind of a idyllic late 40s through the 50s upbringing in some ways. Now, his real breakthrough, and Marie will say some more about this too, is working with Mel Brooks. on Silent Movie in 1976 and High Anxiety in 1977. I'll let Marie in a little bit talk about him as an actor in films like that, but let me talk about him as a writer in films like that, because he's part of that group. I've met Mel Brooks, and believe me, it's a high octane personality. He's always on, always tripping. You got to be able to keep up with him, right? Like, you think I talk fast, listen to these guys talk. You know, it's all shtick, right? It's all like Catskills routines. But anyway, when I talk with Levinson in 1979, bear in mind that High Anxiety, which is a Mel Brooks spoof of Alfred Hitchcock movies, had just come out 2 years previously. I knew Barry Levinson for that as much as anything, because I really liked that film, being a Hitchcock buff. And I wanted to talk with him about Mel Brooks and specifically High Anxiety. And he said that when he worked with Mel Brooks, let me give the exact quote. This is what he told me in 1979. Barry Levinson said, quote, along with the other writers, I saw Hitchcock's movies and put in things that Mel Brooks would like. Hitchcock saw the film. I think he liked it. As for Mel, he wants people to fall on the floor, break up, and have trouble breathing. Now, Marie, at this point, let me turn it back to you to talk about where you actually, if you watch High Anxiety, which I highly recommend, where you can actually see Barry Levinson in the film. Marie, explain.
And I love pointing this out to my students because, you know, even my students who haven't seen his movies, they've heard his name because he's just extremely well known. I did want to mention, though, before I say something about High Anxiety, that in 1968, when he was taking acting classes, he went with his friend George. His friend George was the one who was really interested. He just went along for the ride. And then he got more interested and George kind of fell by the wayside. And he really didn't, you know what happened to the guy until the movie Blow came out in 2001. And he found out that the Johnny Depp character, who was like the biggest cocaine kingpin dealing in America, was based on his friend George. So see, you know, you can go one of two ways. Keep up those acting classes or go completely the other direction. The only saving grace there is that Johnny Depp plays you in the movie of your life. But in High Anxiety, it is a spoof on a lot of Hitchcock movies, but I think the funniest sequence is the one that is making fun of the shower sequence in Psycho. And so in it, Barry Levinson plays a bellboy and Mel Brooks says, you know, can you bring me up a newspaper? And he's, I'll get around to it. But anyway, Mel Brooks' character is very insistent. And he finally ends up reenacting the shower scene with the rolled up newspaper, you know, hitting Mel Brooks with it, you know, with the same sorts of reaction shots you see in Psycho with the knife with Janet Leigh. And then, of course, he throws the newspaper down. And instead of seeing the blood swirling into the drain, it's the newsprint coming off. And that always gets a big laugh from everybody because they recognize exactly what it's supposed to be making fun of. And it's just incredibly clever the way that Mel Brooks does all of his spoofs. And then, you know, he pulls the curtain down, you know, plink, 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 each shower curtain piece going at, you know, in order. And then you see the close-up of Mel Brooks' face and he says, that kid gets no tip. Very, very funny movie. What would follow High Anxiety is going to be Diner, you know, the first of the four Baltimore movies. And I think this is the movie that he is most known for. And like you say, you know, people have said, well, which one of those characters is really Barry Levinson? And he said, none of them, but all of them. But I think a lot of people think the Tim Daly character is the closest to, you know, what he's really like. Now, in outside of the classroom, but in other, you know, situations where this movie becomes iconic, I'm part of a learning community on language and linguistics this semester. So we talk about, it's a bunch of extremely pedantic English teachers all talking about, you know, parsing words. And so the sandwich scene from Diner was used as an example of not beating around the bush, because there's a whole extended sequence where, you know, one of the characters has a roast beef sandwich and another one wants to eat it, but he doesn't want to come right out and say it. And so the whole bit is about, say the words, say you want the roast beef sandwich. It's funnier than I'm making it seem, but what's your favorite scene, Mike, from Diner?
Well, that's certainly one of my favorite scenes. Let me quickly also point out, though, that when Levinson was back in Baltimore for Injustice for All, again, Norman Jewison's the director, but he co-wrote the script with Valerie Curtin, his then wife. He received an Academy Award nomination for that script for Injustice for All. And when he and I were talking about it, because that's why we're sitting down for the interview in 79, he said that when he wrote that script or co-wrote it, he always had Baltimore in mind. It was going to be shot in the Baltimore courthouse. It was going to be shot in the streets. It's worth pointing all that out by way of backstory, because when he finally makes his directorial debut with Diner in 1982, in part, it's because he'd gotten so much positive recognition for Injustice for All. I got to say, I wish I liked that film more than I do. It's kind of heavy-handed with the script, but it's effective. But it's like a sledgehammer's effective sometimes. You know, satirically it works, I think, but again, not exactly subtle ever. But anyway, whatever my mixed feelings about Injustice for All, it's like a calling card for opportunities. In his case, he's writing a lot of other movies at that time, Inside Moves, various other films he's a screenwriter on. Finally, he gets the big invitation to direct Diner, his directorial debut. Not surprisingly, Barry Levinson, being a Baltimore guy and a Diner guy, knows it's got to be shot in Baltimore. And what he does is he works exceptionally well with actors, himself being an actor. As Marie and I have been saying, he's got this background in acting as much as anything, stand-up comedy, he works well. He likes to do what's called controlled improvisation. Let me give an example from Diner, and not a particular scene, but any number of scenes where he does this. Almost always when you're making a film, you're the director, you're really clear about calling action, and then at the end of the scene, cut. Levinson sometimes wouldn't do that, not because he was forgetful, but the actors are kind of fidgeting, they're running lines, they're trying things out. Sometimes he would quietly tell the cinematographer, start rolling. And he would get things that really weren't meant to be on film, but then he would later use. Likewise, at the end of a scene, when the actors had done their last scripted line, sometimes they keep going. You know what I mean? You're like, you're in the mood, you're in tone, you're upset, whatever you're saying next. He would keep the camera going and he wouldn't call cut and he would use that. He also would use it with extras. Like he would quietly tell the camera operator, turn it on, while the extras in the background, because a lot of his Baltimore films are period pieces, right? So, you know, they're all in costume, they're trying out their lines and their attitudes. So yeah, get that, get her expression, get the way this guy looks off to the side and lights a cigarette. They didn't know they were being filmed. I mean, it's like really almost like guerrilla filmmaking in a big budget Hollywood film, but yeah, turn on the camera. Now, in terms of the ensemble and Diner, over the years, I've met most of the cast actually, because they've either been here for other things or they've been back for reunions. There was like a 30th anniversary reunion screening of Diner in Baltimore, things like that. But you've got Kevin Bacon, Mickey Rourke, Steve Guttenberg, Daniel Stern, Ellen Barkin. I mean, really good actors who are really young at this point. These are all names we know from future careers, but they're just starting out here and they work so well off each other. And Marie mentioned, you know, the sandwich scene, which is absolutely one of the best scenes in the film. Why does that work? The reason it works is because it's not conventional Hollywood screenplay writing. Ordinarily, in any well-constructed Hollywood film, and I'm talking stereotypically here, but typically every line of dialogue has to advance the story, right? I mean, obviously in like a thriller or a mystery film or something, every line is just pregnant with meaning or, you know, somehow ominous or at least tipping you off to what's going to come next, you know. But this is a film that reminds me in some ways of a film from 1955, Marty, with Ernest Borgnine. Because in that film, it got a lot of attention for the reasons I'm citing right now. In that film, it was about this verging on middle-aged butcher, kind of a schlub, just, you know, like he's not married, no prospects, just kind of, I mean, well-liked and a nice guy, but just like a nowhere kind of existence, still living with his mother. There you go. There's the nail in the coffin. Still living with mom. And he's going on and on about how his life isn't amounting to anything and women don't look at him and this and that. And so he does have one or two male friends who are also losers, if I can put it that way. But, you know, so he's sitting with a friend and they're talking about, well, what do you want to do tonight? I don't know. What do you want to do tonight? And it goes on for a minute or two. Nothing happens in this conversation. Nothing's happening in their lives. That scene is often cited as an example of prototypical Barry Levinson dialogue. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? So in Diner, a lot of the best scenes, like the sandwich scene, are guys just sitting at the table BSing. They're just talking, shooting the breeze, teasing each other, and having the kinds of arguments where you've had the same argument 100 times before. Like, I'm sitting here eating my sandwich, and you're looking at it, and you really would like to have a bite of that sandwich, but you're not going to come out and ask me directly. You're just going to indirectly say, by the way, you're going to finish that sandwich? And so why don't you, if you want it, just ask for it. Now, Marie, we could talk about other scenes in Diner, and certainly in his Baltimore films, that are the equivalent of that, where it's just like nothing momentous happens, but that's the whole point. And it's yet another reason why improv is so important to him. And all the actors in Diner, I remember Ellen Barkin and Daniel Stern, other people talking about this, they've all remarked on it, that among the directors they've worked with, Levinson will say, well, here's the scripted line. What do you think? What would you bring to it? And he has no reservations whatsoever. After all, he's the screenwriter, right? But he's not possessive always. I mean, he can be on occasion, that's the line. But more often it's like, well, what do you think? And then they might try shooting it a different way. He's got the ultimate decision, but he's really open to an actor saying, let me try this, let me try that. And other actors who've worked with him, like Dustin Hoffman, who can be tough to work with, have credited him with that, because Hoffman likes to, as a method style actor, likes to bring himself to it. And we'll talk about the later career in this respect, but the fact that he's open to that. He says, okay, let's try it your way. And he really will try it their way.
You know, I think the genius of the improv background and the conversations that happen in Diner is, like you said, Mike, this is how people actually talk. So you feel like you're listening to real people, not scripted people, like it's not a play. Everything's not deliberate. It brings out character because you feel like you're listening in on something that's really like a conversation real people would have. So he would then do Tin Men in 1987. It's a strange little movie because it's about, you know, rival aluminum siding salesmen, which you wouldn't think would be rife for entertainment. But this was a movie I actually saw when it came out with my mom. So I just kind of remember that was special in that way. The exterior for the Life magazine scam scene, by the way, is Barry Levinson's childhood home in Baltimore. So talk about putting yourself in the movie. I mean, he, you know, kept telling the production designer, you know, about the house that he was looking for, you know, three-story wooden structure with a little lawn set back from the road and in need of a new frame. And he said, go to 4211 Springdale Avenue, which is the house where he grew up. You know, I want to make sure we get to talk about like some of the highlights as we like kind of blaze through his career, starting with The Natural in 1984, where a middle-aged guy comes out of nowhere to become a legendary baseball player. This is the Robert Redford movie that he did. And the newsreel announcer's name is Ed Kraczynski, which, as you mentioned, is Barry Levinson's mom's maiden name. Then, of course, Good Morning Vietnam in 1987, which he was advised not to do because Robin Williams was such a difficult man to work with. But before I go any further, Mike, jump in here before I get all the way to Rain Man.
I do want to mention in Tin Men, which starred Danny DeVito and Richard Dreyfuss. And I had met DeVito before, actually, when he was in town to shoot that. And he has a perfect personality for a Barry Levinson film because he's, you know, he's hyper. He's always talking. He's always, you know, verbal that way. And so improv, not a problem, right? So in that, they play aluminum siding salesman, and it's a very funny film. My favorite scene is the one Marie mentioned. And when I interviewed Levinson for that film, he said, yeah, that's my house. He said, you know, they're describing, this is what we're looking for. Well, just go to this address and there's your house. But that really is my favorite scene in Tin Men because they're always running these very creative, very illegal scams to sell. The aluminum siding is good. They're not so good in terms of ethics, right? So the scam here is the two of them pretend that they're Life magazine photographers. At that point, Life, the picture magazine, was such a best-selling magazine. People everywhere had it and knew about it. So they're set up on the front lawn, and the proverbial Baltimore housewife is inside looking out through them. And she's like, what are these men doing on my front lawn? She goes out like, excuse me. She's got this really thick Baltimore accent. Excuse me, what are you doing? And they say, oh, ma'am, we're with Life magazine. And Life magazine? Well, yes, ma'am. Like, we're doing a series of houses that, you know, as is, and that have been also others have been renovated. So we want your house as the before house. This is a house with wood shingles, and, you know, it's kind of showing its age and all. And then next to it in the magazine, we'll have a photograph of the after house of another house in a different neighborhood that's had aluminum siding put on it. And she says, wait a minute. You want my house as the before house? Can't my house be the after house? And they say, oh, ma'am, we're sorry, but yours is perfect for the before house. And she says, but I have Life magazine on my coffee table. My neighbors are going to see it there. Is there any way I could be the after house? And they said, well, ma'am, you know, we actually know some people who do aluminum siding. They're really busy, but maybe they can fit you into the schedule. And so before you know it, she signed up to get aluminum siding on her house. But the acting is perfect there. Not only the guys running the scam, but this, you know, Baltimore extra, basically, she's only in the movie for a minute, right? He knows how to cast locally. And in fact, some of my friends and acquaintances have been in his movies as extras. I can point them out as well as pointing out the houses, but they know how to cast. Like, she's got the look, she's got the voice, she's perfect for it. And so Tin Men is full of scenes like that, just very funny scenes. But it, on the face of it, it's kind of an odd story, you're right. But let's, in the interest of time, just jump ahead to Rain Man. I'll let you talk about that a bit, because it's really the film that means so much in his career in terms of being at the apex, the pinnacle of the Hollywood establishment. Rain Man, when it comes out in 1988, starring, of course, Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise as, you know, brothers, it won the Academy Awards for, among other things, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Actor for Dustin Hoffman. It's really at the top of the mountain there. And it's a very big commercial hit. His Baltimore films do well, but Rain Man is a big commercial hit. So back to you, Marie.
And, you know, the interesting thing about Rain Man, and I, you know, I forgot about this until I really started thinking about that movie again. This was the movie that kind of introduced autism to general public awareness. People didn't talk about it. It hadn't been defined in that way before. And it really put a face on autism. So it's groundbreaking if for that reason alone. And Dustin Hoffman was not sure he was getting it right. At one point, he wanted to walk out. He said, you know, I can't do this. Get Richard Dreyfuss. But then, of course, he finished the movie. And like you mentioned, he got his second Academy Award for this work. And at first, when Levinson was offered the movie, he turned it down and made Good Morning Vietnam instead. It's funny how those decisions tend to, you know, you don't really know what the outcome is going to be until later. And, you know, I wanted to mention that they told him not to do Good Morning Vietnam because Robin Williams was such a difficult person to work with, unpredictable. But he would then make Toys in 1992 with Robin Williams. And this was, I think, the big flop. And, you know, people would say to him, you know, I hated that movie, but this was something he worked on for over 10 years, you know, and then spent 10 months to shoot. And he said in interviews that, you know, you have to really like the project because you're going to be devoting 6 months or a year to it. So, you know, in order to put that kind of time into a project, it has to be, there has to be something to it that keeps you interested in making that particular story. Now, the next movie I really want to talk about is my favorite Barry Levinson movie, which is 1997's Wag the Dog. So did you have anything to add before we talk about Wag the Dog, Mike?
Yeah, I quickly want to mention my favorite Barry Levinson movie, which we haven't really talked about yet. I agree with you. Toys from 1992 is his absolute worst film. I mean, everyone should have a dud, and he has a dud bear. Just terrible film. So, you know, not worth spending more time on, really. But this is where, at this point in his career, he's still riding high, but kind of, you know, bouncing around a little bit because Toys in 92 is one of his worst films. The year before that, one of his better received films, Bugsy, in 1991, stars Warren Beatty as the gangster Bugsy Siegel. It receives 10 Academy Award nominations. It's a really well-crafted film. I mean, I like it well enough, but it's just really well-made. He knows production design, let's put it that way, not just in his Baltimore films. It's like letter perfect in terms of how it should look. But my favorite Barry Levinson film comes out the year before that, Avalon, 1990. I think it's his greatest film. I think it's a masterpiece. I saw it at an early preview in 1990, and I interviewed Armin Mulwich-Stahl, who plays the paterfamilias in that. He's the head of the household, if you will, Mr. Krasinski. great performance. And right down the line, again, with ensemble acting, Aidan Quinn, Kevin Pollak, Elizabeth Perkins, Joan Plowright, who manages to play a Jewish woman in Baltimore. I mean, you know, versatile actress there, you know, British actress. But anyway, you got Aidan Quinn, Kevin Pollak, Elizabeth Perkins, Joan Plowright, Lou Jacoby, Elijah Wood, just beautifully acted. It's a long story to try to summarize it, but it's a generational or multi-generational saga. The paterfamilias, played by Armin Mueller-Stahl, comes to Baltimore in 1914. And in voiceover and through scenes, flashbacks describing the family's history from those early decades up through the point where you go from the row house neighborhood to suburbia, which would be like, you know, Forest Park, you know, to get out of the row house neighborhoods and into a leafy quasi suburb, if you will. And of course, you know, the Jim Plowright character is wondering, you know, but does the streetcar go that far? You know, how will we get anywhere? Levinson received an Academy Award nomination for his script for that. So again, you know, the movies we're talking about very often get Academy Award recognition because people know what a good writer he is, what a gifted writer. But anyway, with Avalon, I'd highly recommend that you see it because of how exceptionally well acted it is and just how well produced it is. It's just a beautifully mounted film. And I got to say, of all his Baltimore films, and the one that comes later is Liberty Heights, it's the one where you see so much of the city and it's so recognizable. And I would love to sit with each of you individually and point out scene by scene, oh, that house is in Mount Vernon Place and that street, I've been on that street. And he shows street signs. He wants local people to know, you know, yes, that's Linden Avenue. That's in Reservoir Hill. Because friends of mine who were Jewish and of that generation, that's the block they lived on. And one of my best friends actually is an extra in Avalon. He plays a Jewish merchant, you know, and he, you know, he holds up like the chicken he's got for sale there. You know, this is like Holland's Market, like open air markets. How much more Baltimore could you get than that, hon? So back to you.
Oh, that was awesome that you got a hon in there. That's fabulous, Mike. Well, you know, I'm going to make my case for Wag the Dog because I think this movie is just hilarious and frighteningly accurate. It's a story about a presidential campaign where they think that they're doing badly. So what they're going to do is to get reelected, they're going to start a war and, you know, use the coverage to push the story off the front page about the incumbent president having something going on with a campfire girl. And what happens is it's just hilarious what unfolds, because Dustin Hoffman is hired to manage it as if it's a film production, which he does. And the scenes in it just get more and more outrageous until the final resolution at the end. What's funny about the filming of this movie is that Barry Levinson and Dustin Hoffman and Robert De Niro happened to be in a Washington, D.C. hotel when President Bill Clinton stopped by and, you know, sat with them and said, "So what's the movie about?" And then they couldn't figure out what to say. If you watch the movie, you'll understand why that is actually so hilarious. I want to make one final mention of something that he did. Al Pacino won the Emmy for this performance in You Don't Know Jack from 2010, which is about Jack Kevorkian. Really interesting story, really well acted, just all around interesting later work, I would say, or more recent work that he has done. So I would recommend Avalon, Wag the Dog, and You Don't Know Jack as my top three picks. How about you, Mike?
I also love Wag the Dog because when it came out, it was so prophetic. And in fact, it was coinciding, you know, with Bill Clinton's problems in the White House in terms of infidelity. And in Wag the Dog, it's a firefly girl or whatever, basically campfire girl, you know, Girl Scout kind of thing. But let's distract the public. And I love the idea of, well, let's make up a war with, and guess what? They pick Albania because people don't know much about it, but it was a communist country and they probably don't like us. And we'll make up a story that they've got a suitcase bomb, which they've smuggled into Canada and they're going to bring across the border, all made up. And so everything they show is so fake. And my favorite scene in Wag the Dog is actually where they're actually shooting some of the fake news footage, where in effect, they're going to have Kirsten Dunst, actually, she plays, you know, this young woman who's pretending she's Albanian, you know, and she's holding a kitten. And I don't want a cat, you know, because Dustin Hoffman's a Hollywood producer and Robert De Niro is the political handler. And it's like, well, not just any cat. We want a kitten. You're bringing me cats. I want a kitten. So she's going to hold this kitten and run out of her burning village looking for rescue. All of it's faked. It's all green screen fakery. It's all costumes and makeup and this and that. And she asked the Robert De Niro character at one point, "Can I put this on my resume?" She's like an ambitious young actress. She says, no, you can't. She said, "But what if I do?" She says, "Well, men will come to your house and kill you. You know, you can't put this on your resume." So anyway, I love that film so much. And watching it again now, which I did for our show here, it's still, not only does it hold up, it no longer seems far-fetched at all. Oh, it seems like, you know, ripped from the headlines. Yes, what's fake? What's phony? This is what the world we live in, you know, which is fake in some ways. In terms of the Jack Kevorkian film and so on, he's been working more often in television in recent years. I asked him about this. He's had trouble raising money for Hollywood feature films with big budgets because that whole market has changed so much. The kind of movie he makes, he doesn't make superhero movies, right? He doesn't make that kind of big budget special effects driven thing. The kind of movies he makes, whether comedies or dramas, it's increasingly difficult to raise the money to make them. He wanted to make another Baltimore film based on his novel 66. I asked him about that. And I said to him, I said, "Your novel reads like a screenplay." And so I know, he says, he smiles. He said, "I know," he says, "I wanted it to become a screenplay. So I couldn't raise the money to make it in Hollywood or in Baltimore, even for that matter. And I refused to shoot it in Toronto." He said, "I'm not going to make a Baltimore movie in Toronto." So that's never been done. That was to have been his next Baltimore film. Talking about his generation of characters in the mid-1960s, 1966, where were they as everything was changing in the 60s? He's never made it, but he's made some good films for television, as you point out.
Well, that brings us to the end of our episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com, and we will see you at the movies.
You there.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.